Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And hello, everyone, whether you're listening in the morning, the afternoon, or whenever, welcome to Writers' Voices.
And it's another lovely Iowa day. Maybe some
so
rain.
Far.
So far, maybe getting some rain. While when we're recording this, who knows what it is like when you're listening to it. Hopefully the weather is great wherever you are. Or
amen.
Or raining, if that's what you need.
Yes.
So, Mom, what do we have in store for our listeners today?
Well, you're in for a treat today. This book is called Vox, V-O-X, and it's by Christina Dulcher. And Christina has earned her doctorate in theoretical linguistics from Georgetown University. She specializes in the phonetics of sound change in Italian and British dialects and has taught in several universities. Her short stories and flash fiction, appear in more than 100 journals worldwide. Recognition includes the Bath Flash Award shortlist, nominations for the Pushcart Prize, and multiple other awards. She lives in Norfolk, Virginia with her husband, and we'd like to welcome her to the program today. This is the most unusual book I've ever read, and it's something else. I mean, I just highly recommend it, I'll tell you.
It's
well, thank you, Caroline.
So Vox is, welcome, Christina.
Thanks, Caroline. Thanks, Monica. I'm really glad to be here today.
When I started reading it, it was one that I really had to finish. And unfortunately, I had to give it to Mom before I could finish it, so she had a chance to read it. So now I have to get it back. Because
you have to get it back. Yes, you do. I'm not going to give away the ending because
no spoilers here today.
No spoilers.
Fingers crossed.
No spoilers. But it's one of those you can't put it down books. I mean, it's just one of those, you know. So give yourself some time when you're going to read it and enjoy.
So you obviously, Christina, came to this. To writing this book, which, by the way, is getting a lot of buzz. It's your first novel, right?
It is my first published novel. I've got a few others in the unpublished pile.
In the proverbial drawer.
Exactly.
But it's getting a lot of buzz. I can certainly understand why. It's the number one library reads pick, the Indie Next pick, a Barnes & Noble Discover pick. But you brought your kind of professional expertise to this novel and then built amazingly gripping story around it.
Well, thank you. Linguistics is such a huge field. And so I'm not a neurolinguist, although I have done some coursework in neurolinguistics. So I'm familiar with aphasia from a, I won't say from a layperson's point of view, from something more than that, but something less than an expert. But it is quite interesting for me to bring linguistics into my writing because I don't think there are really very many linguists out there who have turned into fiction writers.
And probably not.
And as a consequence, you know, we linguists, we're sort of there in our ivory tower bubble, you know, working on the next revision of some really esoteric theory that nobody normal really cares about. And so as a consequence, you know, of us doing such a bad job at marketing ourselves and kind of telling people in the world that linguistics is really cool. Language is really cool. This is something we all do. We don't need to be taught how to speak. It just happens when we're 3 years old. And we do it perfectly. And then I think what ends up being the case is that we take it for granted, right? Look at the words that we've spoken. I guarantee you that we've each said a number of sentences that are completely unique, that have never been said before, just in these past 5 minutes. And we're not thinking about how that works. We're not figuring out how to form sentences or which kinds of endings we need to put on a verb or a noun to make it agree with this or that. We're not thinking about subjects and objects or tense or anything. We're just doing it. It's like magic. And so it was really a joy to kind of write a book that is a commercial thriller, but that also has some elements of linguistics in it that I hope really will make people think just for a moment, oh my God, I do this. I speak 16,000 or 20,000 words a day or whatever it is. And I don't even realize what I'm doing, but they all make sense. So that was really, that was just great.
Most people make sense when they talk, not all.
Okay. All right. There are, I did have a professor to whom I dedicated Vox, actually. He passed away a few years ago, very suddenly and unfortunately very young. And I do remember him saying that he used to limit us to 2 pages whenever we wrote papers for his syntax classes. Because he said most people end up losing their minds between the first word of the sentence and the last. I think that's probably where I got my passion for flash fiction. I was trained to write really, really short.
Oh, interesting. Well, I have a number of questions here. First of all, what exactly is linguistics?
Great question. And you would be, I think you win the prize. Because of all the interviews I've done in here and in Europe, nobody has asked me that yet.
Wow.
Right. Like I said, rubbish job of marketing ourselves. It's all the fault of the linguists. And I'm sorry, linguists. You know I love you, but we need to get the word out. So, okay, let me tell you what linguistics is not, because that's easy. Or easier than what I'm about to tell you. One, linguistics is not studying languages. It's not learning how to speak multiple languages. It's not being a polyglot. It's also not studying about translation. What linguistics is studying language, but it's language with a capital L. It's all of language. So there's a theory out there, universal grammar theory, that basically says that languages are a lot more alike than they are different, right? They follow rules. There are patterns. Any native speaker, even a native speaker who's never taken a course in linguistics, will automatically be able to detect whether a sentence is grammatical or not grammatical. Whether a sentence works. When I say grammatical, I mean whether it works in that language. So if I say that the dog bit the postman, we all know that that's a perfect English sentence. If I say bit the dog the postman, we all know that that's not a perfect English sentence. We might not even know why, but we know it. So linguistics is the study of what is possible in language, what can work in a language, in any given language, what languages have in common. And there are two goals. One is to describe the ins and outs of a particular language or of languages in general. And another one is to explain how it is possible for a 3-year-old to get this amazingly complex system without any over instruction. And when you think about the fact that we've got a finite set of words, a limited set of words, and a finite set of rules that tell us how to put those words together and pronounce those words and create meaning out of those words, when we take those two finite sets, the fact is that we are able to generate an infinite number of sentences from these two finite sets. So that is one of the things that linguistics does. I hope I didn't get too technical there, but I really am. If I sound like I'm trying to boggle your mind and make you open your mouth and go, wow, I am. I am trying to do that because it's amazing. And, you know, sure, we take classes in writing and spelling and reading and everything else. But the fact is, Caroline, you'll remember this from when Monica was 3 years old. She was speaking. You didn't have to sit down with her and go over all these rules. She just did it. So that's what linguists try to figure out. How in the world can that happen?
Well, a child listens and imitates, right?
Sure. But there's so much that's not said. There's so much evidence that's actually not given to that child. So there's a famous little bit about a teacher saying, or a mother talking to her child, and the child keeps saying, the teacher holded the baby rabbits. And the mother says, you mean the teacher held the baby rabbits? And the child keeps repeating and insisting that the teacher holded the baby rabbit. So there's good evidence, actually, that kids are not just imitating. they're actually generating things based on this set of rules, and they're working with this set of rules. It's quite amazing.
I have a funny story. When my daughter was about 3 years old, her dad took her to the doctor for a checkup, and she came to meet me afterwards, and she said, the doctor said he wanted to eat me, like I was a salad. And I'm like, what in the world? And, you know, I got a little worried here. And I said, Daniel, were you there the whole time? What's she talking about? He said, yeah, I was in the room the whole time. And then he goes, oh, he went to pick her up and put her on the table. And he said, wow, you certainly are a solid girl.
Oh, that's excellent.
Yeah.
And another great example that, you know, kids are doing their own things sometimes with language. So we've moved beyond B.F. Skinner, who did say that they're imitating. Mm-hmm. And we moved on to Chomsky, who said, no, they're not imitating, they're generating. So there was a really big, bright line that was drawn in the 1950s when Chomsky, who's kind of the father of modern linguistics, published his first works.
Well, what always fascinates me is how different languages are in the way that they not in, you know, it doesn't surprise me that people separately develop different words for things, but that they use such different sounds that it can be very difficult for an English speaker, for example, to really even make the sounds of some other languages.
Absolutely. I mean, this is another thing that we learn as small children, and we are hearing these things. We've got a very large set of possible sounds in human languages, a very large set. But of course, not every language makes use of all of those sounds. A language will choose some subset of those sounds, whether they're consonants or vowels. And children learn to identify the sounds in their first languages very, very early on, long before 3 years old. And they just sort of rule out all the other ones. And so from a sort of phonetic standpoint, it does become very difficult. I mean, look at, if you've ever studied French, there's that funny French U sound, like in tu. For the word for you, T-U. And, you know, we just don't have that U in English. We have an U and we have an E, but we don't have an U, which is somewhere in the middle. So this is another interesting thing that people do with when they, and it, you know, then we have to go back to like Piaget and the theory of learning. What do people do when they're confronted with a new thing? They can either assimilate or they can accommodate. So they'll either create a new category for it, or they'll put it into an existing category, something that they're comfortable with. And this is why, for instance, if you go into a French 101 class, you're going to hear a lot of English-speaking students saying tu instead of tu, right? Because they don't want to create that new category. They want to put it into the closest category that they have. And this, you know, Piaget was not just talking about language. He was talking about what happens when we're confronted with any new thing. This is, for instance, your kid probably once saw, I don't know, a horse and called it a dog, right? Mm-hmm. Because it had four legs and fur on it, or hair, right? it was an animal, not a human. And if the kid hasn't seen a horse yet, but has seen a lot of dogs, then what are they doing? They're just putting it into that category.
Well, you know, that's another thing that always puzzled me is how we all know that this animal, that a Chihuahua is a dog and a Great Pyrenees is a dog. They are so unlike each other. And yet
Absolutely. We
look at all the, any type of animal and that is a dog, and we somehow know that it's a dog.
Absolutely. Dog, and this is that's the field of semantics now that we're talking about, and categories, and I mean, sets and subsets. I mean, it truly is fascinating. And
it what is, we're but doing we better is, get back notice, to your book.
We better get back to the book, because now we've kind of branched into the, you know, meta-theoretical sort of area of, of, you know, what knowledge is, and we could go on for that. I'd have to write a whole new book.
Yeah, really. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Christina Dalcher, author of Vox. So what is the premise of Vox, and how does linguistics play a part in this book?
Well, on the surface, we have a dystopian world in Vox, a very near future dystopian world, where very little has changed, actually, except for the fact that all females are fitted with a bracelet that counts their words, and they're limited to 100 words per day. So it's shocking, actually.
I mean, it is
both figuratively and literally, because there are in fact penalties for exceeding those words. So there's one sense in which Vox is a dystopian novel about what happens when a particular faction gains power and decides to silence a large portion of the population. Now, as for how linguistics fits into it, there are a couple of different ways. One is simply this this silencing, and I worked in language. I worked in the concept of voice, and vox, as you know, and for anybody who doesn't know, is Latin, the Latin word for voice. The voice factors in to vox in two different ways. One, in a very easy to see way, that is, women and female girls are limited in the way that they use their voices. They can only speak 100 words. But there's another way. There's a sort of metaphorical voice. There's the voice that my main character, Jean McClellan, the neurolinguist, never used when she was younger. The voice that she could have used to speak up or to vote or to write to her congressmen or her senators. The voice that she could have used to protest something that she didn't agree with. She didn't use this. And as a consequence, she is now without a voice. This is one way that linguistics figures in to Vox. There's another way as well. And it has to do with the notion of a critical period. for language acquisition. And what do I mean by that? Well, the general theory is that we, as human beings, need to learn our first language by a particular time, by the time we're about 14 or 15 years old, right? While all our brains are still plastic enough. If we do not do that, we probably risk not learning our language at all. And there's some evidence for this. It's rare evidence because obviously we don't do experiments on children to deny them language and see what happens. That would be cruel and it would be inhumane and horrible. But in fact, there have been cases in the past where we've found children who are feral, who are wild children in the sense that they have grown up not being exposed to language. One famous case is Victor of Avignon. This was, I believe, late 18th century France. And François Truffaut made an excellent movie called L'Enfant Sauvage, which means the wild child, about this case. Another more recent case, and one that was on my mind while I was writing Vox, and also that's discussed a little bit in Vox to kind of drive the point home about how serious this situation is the case of Jeannie, who she was known as the wild child. There's a book, I believe, and a wonderful documentary on her by PBS. She was found by social services in the early 1970s in Southern California. She had been severely abused by her parents, locked into a room and not socialized at all. Her parents really didn't speak to her. She was not exposed to language. When she was found, she was nearly 14 years old. So let's think about that. Nearly 14 years of not being exposed to language. The consequences, of course, for poor Jeannie were dire. Even with a team of linguists and psychologists and so on, and a lot of grant money being thrown in this direction, Jeannie did not acquire language the way all other children acquire language. So this is quite frightening. And yes. When we look at Jean's daughter in Vox, Sonia, who is 6 years old, who is living in a world where all she knows is that she gets 100 words per day, we have to wonder, is her language going to be acquired as her brother's languages are acquired? Or is she at risk of really having a degraded linguistic system? So that's actually very frightening. It was very frightening to me, and much more frightening than the concept of the political pressure and the 100-word limit and so on and so forth.
When Vox opens, it's been about a year since these counters were put on all the women.
Right.
And we get a little backstory of how, kind of how it happened. And one of the things is, like, how could something like this happen? How could it go this far? And, you know, Mom, when she was reading it, asked me, do you think, you know, something like this could really happen? I said, well, look at the Taliban. I mean, people...
Yeah.
You know,
sure.
People in power do try and silence others. And, you know, and under the Taliban rule, girls weren't allowed to go to school. I mean, look at slavery in the United States, where black people were not allowed to learn to read.
Under right.
Punishment
right.
Of, you know, severe punishment. And it seems,
right.
On one hand, it seems like impossible that any human being would want to do this to another human being. And yet history tells us otherwise.
It does seem impossible. It does seem impossible, and yet it's horrifyingly true. I was just in Baltimore the other day, and I took a tour of there are a number of ships that are not in use anymore that are docked around Baltimore, and you can go and visit them. And since my husband was in the Coast Guard, I thought, this will be a good treat for him. You know, we'll go on boats. and one of them was actually very, very integral in the abolition of the slave trade. And there were some absolutely shocking renderings of slave ships and the, you know, to use that horrible euphemism, cargo holds, which weren't cargo holds, they were human holds. And they're just absolutely sickening to look at. But in fact, this did happen. In fact, we've seen eugenics movements and ethnic cleansing movements. We've seen Ceausescu's Romania, where reproductive rights were also controlled. We know that Switzerland just gave the vote to women in the 1970s. We've seen Boko Haram. We've seen Nazi Germany. We've seen the eugenics movement in the United States, a movement that no one wants to talk about, but in fact it happened. Kids being shuttled off to state schools. We saw the rise of the therapeutic lobotomy in the 1950s here in our own country. your mom probably remembers the actress Frances Farmer. And so these things actually do happen. I mean, we know they happen because they have. History tells us this, even though sometimes we try to clean up our history books a little bit. Now, do I really think that we're going to ever get to a point where women are wearing wrist counters that limit them to 100 words a day or any number of words a day? I don't think so. I really don't. But things can happen. And I guess the real message in Vox is, even though Vox paints a very extreme picture, the real message here is we need to pay attention to what is going around in the world, what is going on in the world around us. And, right. And silencing can come from all kinds of different factions, too. In Vox, it happens to be from the right. But we've also seen in recent years, we've seen a lot of silencing happening from the left on college campuses, right? Intolerance doesn't always come from one side. And so it's interesting, and it's very important for me to point that out, because I did write Vox, obviously, with a particular faction being in control and a particular faction being oppressed. But it could have gone the other way. Right? It could have gone the other way. I could have used anyone. And so the message is not, oh, look how bad these fundamentalists are and look how victimized women are. The message is, look how easily someone can take control over your life and you being whoever.
Well, yeah, I think an example of how it can go either way is, you know, in Arab countries, there's countries where the Sunnis were in charge and oppressed the Shiites, and then the Shiites would get in charge and oppress the Sunnis, and
absolutely,
yeah, went back and forth.
Sure, and I think, you know, we see that, right? We see history moving sometimes in sinusoidal waves. I mean, I was thinking about, look at our government, for instance, just here in the States, and we've got two major parties. We've never spent more than 8 years at a time, and we're just talking about the presidency, with, you know, with one particular side in control. It goes up and down.
Right. So in Vox, in the beginning, it's mostly, the action is happening mostly within the family. Dr. Jean McClellan is our heroine here. And her husband works for the government, works as an advisor to the president, and has sort of gone along with this whole thing, even though she thinks he doesn't really support it, that he's sympathetic to her. but he doesn't do anything about it.
Right.
And she has four children, three sons and a daughter. And we get a very vivid picture of how different their lives are. It just from the very first, very first chapter. In fact,
right, we've got a family sitting around dinner, and it just everything seems absolutely normal. This is what people do. Families sit around a dinner table. The kids are back from school. Somebody's home from work, and they talk. Except in talks, the women aren't talking.
Wow. Would you like to read a little bit from Vox for us?
I would love to.
Great.
I have two sort of short pieces. One is a little bit more introspective, and one is a little bit more action-filled. And these are both from the early chapters of the book, where we're still seeing Jean at home and watching her navigate through this. So the first passage happens at night after Jean puts her daughter to bed and goes to bed herself. She's out of words for the day. Her word counter will not reset itself until midnight. So here we are. Sometimes I trace invisible letters on my palm. While Patrick and the boys talk with their tongues outside, I talk with my fingers. I scream and whine and curse about what, in Patrick's words, used to be. This is how things are now. We have allotments of 100 words a day. My books, even the old copies of Julia Child, and here's irony, the tattered red and white checked Better Homes and Gardens a friend decided would be a cute joke for a wedding gift, are locked in cupboards so Sonia can't get at them. Which means I can't get at them either. Patrick carries the keys around like a weight, and sometimes I think it's the heaviness of this burden that makes him look older. It's the little stuff I miss most. Jars of pens and pencils tucked into the corners of every room. Notepads wedged in between cookbooks. The dry erase shopping list on the wall next to the spice cabinet. Even my old refrigerator poetry magnets, the ones Stephen used to concoct ridiculous Italo-English sentences with, laughing himself to pieces. Gone, gone, gone. Like my email account. Like everything. Some of life's little sillinesses remain the same. I still drive, hit the grocery store on Tuesdays and Fridays, shop for new dresses and handbags, get my hair done once a month down at Iannuzzi's. Not that I've changed the cut. I'd need too many precious words to tell Stefano how much to take off here and how much to leave there. My leisure reading limits itself to billboards advertising the latest energy drink, ingredients lists on ketchup bottles, washing instructions on clothing tags. Do not bleach. Riveting material, all of it. Sundays, we take the kids to a movie and buy popcorn and soda, those little rectangular boxes of chocolates with the white nonpareils on top, the kind you find only in movie theaters, never in the shops. Sonia always laughs at the cartoons that play while the audience files in. The films are a distraction. The only time I hear female voices unconstrained and unlimited. Actresses are allowed a special dispensation while they're on the job. Their lines, of course, are written by men. During the first month, I did sneak a peek at a book now and again. Scratch a quick note on the back of a cereal box or an egg carton. Write a love note to Patrick in lipstick on our bathroom mirror. I had good reasons, very good ones. Don't think about them, Jean. Don't think about the women you saw in the grocery store. To keep note writing inside the house.
Then Sonia came in one morning, caught the lipsticked message she couldn't read, and yelped, "Letters! Bad!" I kept communication inside me from that point, only writing a few words to Patrick in the evenings after the kids were in bed, burning the paper scraps in a tin can. With Stephen the way he is now, I don't even risk that. Patrick and the boys out on the back porch close to my window are swapping stories about school, politics, the news, while crickets buzz in the dark around our bungalow. They make so much noise, those boys and those crickets. Deafening. All my words ricochet in my head as I listen, emerge from my throat in a heavy, meaningless sigh. And all I can think about are Jackie's last words to me. Think about what you need to do to stay free. And that's the end of that chapter.
And that's so, Christina Dulcher reading from Vox. And now we have another section.
We do. Right. We do. This is later that night. And everybody in the house is in bed. Again, this is from Jean's perspective. The first time she screams, I think I'm dreaming. Patrick snores beside me. He's always been one to sleep heavily, and his schedule for the past month has run him into the ground. So snore, snore, snore. My sympathy has already expired. Let them work 12-hour days to pick up the inevitable slack that canceling almost half of the workforce brought about. Let them bury themselves in paperwork and administrative nonsense and then limp home only to sleep like the dead and get up and do it all over again. What did they expect? It isn't Patrick's fault. I know this in my heart and in my mind. With four kids, we need the income his job brings in. Still, I'm all dry on sympathy. She screams again, not a wordless scream, but a blood-curdling waterfall of words. Mommy, don't let it get me, don't let it get me, don't let it get me, don't let it get me. I'm out of the bed in a tumble of sheets and quilts, nightdress tangled around my legs. My shin slams into the hard corner of the bedside table, a bullseye on my bone. This one will bleed, leave a scar, but I'm not thinking about that. I'm thinking about the scar I'll own if I don't make it to Sonia's bedroom in time to quiet her. The words continue pouring out, flying through the hall toward me like poisoned darts from a million hostile blowpipes. Each one stings. Each one pierces my once tough skin with the precision of a surgeon's scalpel, driving directly to my gut. How many words has she said? 50? 60? More? More. Oh, God. Now Patrick's up, wide-eyed and pallid, a picture of some silver screen hero fresh with fright on discovering the monster in the closet. I hear his footsteps quick behind me, matching the thrum of blood pulsing through my veins. Hear him yell, "Run, Jean, run." But I don't turn around. Doors open as I fly past them, first Steve, then the twins. Someone, maybe Patrick, maybe me, flaps on the hall light switch, and three blurred faces, pale as ghosts, appear in my peripheral vision. Of course Sonia's room would be the farthest from my own. Mommy, please don't let it get me. Please don't let it get me. Don't. Sam and Leo start crying. For the smallest of moments, I register a single thought. Lousy mother. My boys are in distress, and I'm moving past them, uncaring and oblivious. I'll worry about this damage later, if I'm in the condition to worry about anything. Two steps into Sonia's small room, I vault onto her bed, one hand searching for her mouth, clamping onto it. My free hand gropes under her sheets for the hard metal of the wrist counter. Sonia moans through my palm, and I catch her nightstand clock out of the corner of my eye. 11:30. I have no words remaining, not for the next half hour. Patrick, I mouth when he switches the overhead light on. Four pairs of eyes stare at the scene on Sonia's bed. It must look like a violence, a grotesque sculpture. My writhing child, her nightgown translucent with sweat, me lying sprawled on top of her, suffocating her cries and pinning her to the mattress. What a horrible tableau we must make, infanticide in the flesh. My counter glows 100 over Sonia's mouth. I turn to Patrick, pleading mutely, knowing that if I speak, if the LED turns over to 101, she'll share the inevitable shock. Patrick joins me on the bed, pries my hand from Sonia, replaces it with his own. Shh, baby girl, shh. Daddy's here. Daddy won't let anything happen to you. Sam and Leo and Steve come into the room. They jostle for position, and all of a sudden there's no more room for me. Lousy mother becomes useless mother. Two words ping-ponging in my head. Thanks, Patrick. Thanks, boys. I don't hate them. I tell myself I don't hate them. But sometimes I do. And that's all.
And again, Christina Dolce reading from Vox. Christina, how hard was it to write that scene?
I still get chills when I read it. And I definitely had chills when I wrote it. I wrote it very quickly because there's something about the tension there. It was so frightening that, it was so immediate that I couldn't, I felt it, in a way it was hard to write. In another way, it was very easy to write because in that scene, I actually felt like, and this happens, doesn't happen all the time for writers, and every writer will know this, but when that was happening, I was Jean. Mm. My entire world went away, and all I could think or feel was how desperate I was to not let my little girl speak another word. I still get chills.
Yeah.
It was quite tough. And it was interesting, too, because this was one of the – normally I write very much in a linear way. I just – I have my rough outline for the novel, and I start at word one, and I keep going until I hit the end. But there were a few scenes that kind of came to mind even before I started writing the novel, and this was one of them. So this was written kind of in isolation.
So what was it like then to live in Jean's head the whole time you're writing this? I mean, it must have been very difficult to, when you weren't writing, to come back to reality and live your life. Wasn't that difficult?
I think so. I honestly, it's hard to, people ask me so many questions about how I was feeling or what I was doing when I was writing this. And, I wrote Vox quite quickly. I do remember that I would be writing, in the morning, and then that afternoon I would go out and play tennis. So maybe I have a really sort of finely honed talent for kind of compartmentalizing. I think that must be the case because I would not have been able to function if I'd been constantly living in Jean's head. So. I did write, and then when the writing was done, I said, okay, finished now, time to go do a little gardening or play some tennis or cook some dinner. And of course, I didn't talk about the book either while I was writing it, because every time I tried to talk about it with my husband — this is kind of ironic since I wrote a book about men shutting women up, which my husband never does. but the fact is, he didn't want to hear about the book until it was finished, because he wanted to read it without knowing anything. So So I really didn't tell a lot of people what was going on. I just kind of kept this internalized. And
well, how long did it take you to write this?
It took 2 months.
2 months?
It took two months. I wrote this between May 23rd and July 23rd of 2017.
Oh, my
if you
goodness.
Can believe
that is wicked fast. And
well, I had a really good motivation. I had a novel out on submission, a different novel out on submission to publishers. And I had my agents already. And when I wrote the short story version of Vox, and it was getting some really good feedback from my readers and also from some editors of anthologies that I'd sent it to, I thought, wow, maybe I could turn this into something bigger. So I approached my agent and told her about it. She said, it sounds deliciously creepy. And I thought, okay, well, I'll get writing then. But the thing was, my agent was pregnant at the time. And the baby was due in early November, and she wasn't going to be reading any more client manuscripts after a certain point, I think in September. So I needed to get this thing done. I needed to get it to my readers, make revisions, and then get it to my agent before September. So that was that little fire under me, let's say.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's also kind of amazing that you wrote this in 2017 and it's already out, right? It's already released?
That is amazing. It's unusual. It's
very.
Really unusual. So for anyone out there who is either a writer who is just sort of exploring the route to publication, or even for anyone who's a reader who just doesn't understand how books work, the two operative terms that I'll use to describe the publishing industry, and I mean this in a very nice way, are glacially slow. it's true. I mean, the fact is the road to publication is really can be a very, very long one. If you do not already have an agent, you've got to write a book. You've got to let the book settle, have people give you feedback on the book or workshop it, make revisions. Then you've got to start querying, trying to get an agent. That can take a long time. Then once you do have that agent, you're looking at a number of revisions probably from, that you're getting from your literary agent. Then it will go out on submission to publishers, and it could take weeks, it could take months, it could take many months. When you do get a publishing deal, the average, I think, space between a book deal and seeing your book on the shelves is probably around 18 months. So when you think about all that, the road to publication can be a very, very long one. This did happen quite quickly. My publishers at Berkeley, which is an imprint of Penguin Random House, decided to get this out,
on
fast track.
Is one of the reasons the popularity of the TV series Handmaid's Tale?
I think that could be part of it. I also think that, we always see trends in publishing. So, let's take Stephanie Meyer's Twilight, for example, a series which I love and just gobbled up when I was probably in my 40s, I think. So not just for teenagers. but when that enjoyed so much success, I mean, really an insane amount of success, that what happened was we started seeing this publishing trend, right? People wanted these paranormal romances and vampires and shapeshifters and so on. And of course, trends come and go. We saw trends in young adult dystopian fiction. We saw trends with unreliable narrators more recently. And so it's also possible that publishers, when they sense a trend coming on and perhaps a feminist dystopian fiction trend, you know, is going to be this next one that they, you know, they don't want to be last. I'm only speculating here. also, though, when I was first talking to my editor about this, and we were throwing around, you know, potential publication dates in 2019, I said, well, something's happening in fall 2018. You know, midterm elections.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's also possible.
And one of the messages of this book is get out and vote.
Absolutely. Get out. Use your voice.
Use your
voice. Use your voice while you still can. And I just want to say one thing here. Like, you know, speaking of politics, but I really don't dig in very deep to politics, neither personal politics nor other people's, because I think it's a very private thing, right? I mean, there's a reason that, you know, voting is secret, right? But I think it's really important that people vote for the things they care about. Not everybody is going to care about the same thing. Not everybody needs to care about the same thing. So if, you know, if you've got convictions, and even if they're not the most popular ones, that's okay. You know, I think the important thing is to vote where the way your heart and your soul and your mind tells you to vote, and do the thing that's right for you. So if that makes sense.
Yes, definitely. Now, Christina, you've published a lot of short stories and flash fiction. So
A lot more flash fiction than short stories, actually. Most of the published writing that I have out there is probably around in the 300 to 700 word count category. Yeah.
Does your experience in that help you when it comes to writing a novel?
I think it does in some ways. I do like to write. It helps me because I can think of chapters sometimes as just one sort of cohesive piece of flash that, you know, fits in obviously with the rest of the novel. It helps as far as getting me kind of to think about word choices and rhythm, focusing on just this little bit that I'm writing instead of on the entire plot, instead of getting lost. It's interesting. I think I write in a lean kind of a way. There's not a lot of description in Vox or in some of the other novels that I've written that aren't published yet. And, you know, I don't spend a lot of time talking about the weather or the furniture in a room or what a particular character looks like, because in Flash, there's no room for that, right? Mm-hmm. You've got to get to the meat of things. You've got to make every word count. So it helps in a way, but I could also see a way in which it can be kind of daunting, you know, to go from being very used to writing a story in 300 words, and now you're looking at an 85,000 word novel, which is a lot longer. And so you don't want to just throw filler in there and bore the reader to death, right? I mean, there's a saying, there's no room for filler in a thriller.
Uh-huh.
You know, so you have to keep up the pace. But yes, writing Flash definitely helped me because they're so short, they're such short pieces. It's a way to kind of experiment with different voices, with different characters. I mean, you know, I could write a story about a cat who's a jewel thief one day, and I could write a story about a widowed woman next, and then a story about a cranky old man on his front porch the day after that. And so I think that the flash exercises really did help in kind of getting, you know, into the minds of some of the different characters in Vox and making the dialogue and their voices sort of more realistic.
So getting back to publishing a moment, do you think if this book is obviously a success, going to be even bigger success, so will your next, if you write another novel, will your publisher be more likely to think, oh yeah, let's just go ahead with this? Or, you know, how does that work in the publishing business?
That's an excellent question, Caroline. So actually, when my deal for when I sold Vox, it was a 2-book deal, but not for a follow-on. It was for Vox and another book, which is also a bit dystopian, but has to do with a sort of mania about intelligence testing, and I'm looking back into history at the eugenics movement that was very, very popular in early 20th century and mid 20th century America and in other countries as well. So there's completely different characters, completely different plot, similar theme in the sense that there's an extremism that I'm looking at, right? And I being a fan of dystopian fiction for the past, almost, 4 decades, I do like to write about the dangers of extremism. That said, I've heard from a number of readers that they would like there to be more Vox, and perhaps there's room for that. So we'll see what happens. I think it's all going to depend on how Vox does. And as much as I'd love to agree with you and say, yes, of course it's going to be a success, I don't know. I mean, now at this point, it's a waiting game. And I'll tell you what, writing the novel was easy. Waiting for it to be published was not so easy. And these days after it's published, it's probably the most nerve-wracking time of my life.
Wow. Well, I think once readers get a hold of it, there's no doubt that it's going to do well.
We
don't have
well,
much time, but
I
just wanted to mention the character of Stephen, the teenage son, Jean's teenage son, who just really upset me.
Well, good. I wanted him to, but he's a little complex. I think that he seems all evil on the outside. Somebody actually at a recent bookstore event referred to him as a cross between Rolf from The Sound of Music and Dolores Umbridge from Harry Potter. I did think of him as kind of a Rolf. He is just a terrific example of how the world can change and who is going to be used to change the world. If you want to start a revolution, who are you going to pick to work with you and to form and mold? You're going to pick somebody who's 80 years old? No way. You're going to pick the kids. Going to pick the kids because they're vulnerable, they're malleable.
And Stephen becomes totally enamored with this new way and doesn't seem to have any sympathy for his mother or his sister and their limitations.
No.
He thinks it's a good thing. He gets brainwashed very easily.
He does. He embraces the pure movement and really just, he doesn't think about it very much. And this is something that we learn to do as we grow older. I'm not saying that teenagers are incapable of thinking or of introspection or rational thought, but with experience, I think, does come the ability to analyze what's going on around you in a finer way, and Stephen just doesn't have that ability, which of course is why these movements pick kids. I mean, Charles Manson he's had young people following him, right?
Right.
I mean, he wasn't going after the 40-year-olds. He was looking for the young kids.
Well, Christine, unfortunately, we are out of time.
That's all right. It was a delight talking to you both.
It was our great pleasure. And Mom, do you have some closing words for us?
Yes, I do. Wisdom means knowing what to do. Ability means knowing how to do it. Commitment means doing it. And conviction means knowing why you're doing it.
Now that is a great closing phrase. Thank you, Caroline.
Thank
you're welcome.
You, and see you all next week on Writer's Voices.